This is Channel 253. Channel 253 is sponsored by Alaska Airlines. I'm Nate Bowling and I fly Alaska. To book your next trip, go to alaskaair.com. This is the Nerd Farmer Podcast, a national conversation through a local lens. Greetings, greetings. This is Nate Bowling, host of the Nerd Farmer Podcast, here from not the Moonyard Studios. Today, in fact, I'm actually in my classroom, room 306. It's Wednesday here at Lincoln High School, and the mayor is about to give her State of the City address. And that brings together some folks who you may know. And so after we dropped our evicted episode, two folks dropped me and said, we have more evicted thoughts. And one, it's funny, Matt Driscoll was on the show, has more thoughts. And the other person is Lori Jenkins, state rep. And so we're all sitting here now in my classroom, not the studio. Sorry if it's echoey. That's okay. We'll call this the Pop the Trunk episode of the podcast. So welcome.
Hi, it's great to be here.
All right, so I'm giving this a shot. Just full disclosure for the audience, we're recording on a Tascam portable microphone. If it's terrible, blame Doug. Don't blame Doug, blame me. Lori, you wanted to share some, you had thoughts about the book that you wanted to share with a wider audience, correct?
Yeah, I would just say, first of all, it was funny, when I reached out to you, it was because I wanted to come to the book club discussion because I wanted to hear what other people had to say. I mean, I don't know that I have a lot to say about this other than having read the book. And one of the things that really struck me about the everything in the book is that the same way that we have, in my book, ripped down, especially African-American families by incarcerating Black men, we are doing it at the other end by evicting African-American women. And there was a lot of evidence in the book that African-American women are evicted at much higher rates than are white women or any other class of people who have the same basic economic descriptors. It's just our systemic racism is working at every level. Yeah.
And so, Matt, that was kind of also your thought that you had, too. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I had a few thoughts, and, I'll preface this by saying, I was on the original podcast, and it took place on a Sunday morning after daylight saving. So hopefully that gives us a little bit. I mean, I think the conversation was good, but I left the studio and almost initially went, man, we could have talked about so much more. And one of the thoughts that I really had, and it kind of relates to the systemic racism angle is, we talked a lot, and rightfully so, about affordable housing and the need for affordable housing. And I think that's one piece of this. But what I think we didn't delve enough into is the systemic racism aspect of both eviction and homelessness. And the Monday after we taped that, I came into the office and I wrote a column about a study that was done in, I believe, six places across the country, including Pierce County, which basically looked at the homeless population. And to no surprise, it found that African-Americans were overrepresented in those populations. But kind of one of the interesting findings in that is that it wasn't strictly related to poverty. Like if you look at who's living in deep poverty in the United States, whites are the predominant folks who are experiencing deep, deep poverty. Yet, when you look at the population that is experiencing homelessness, blacks are very much overrepresented in that. And so it brings the question, okay, so why if folks are generally speaking living in states of deep poverty, whites even more so than the blacks in many cases, why are blacks more likely to fall into homelessness than white? And there were a couple of conclusions that the authors of the study kind of fleshed out in that. And one was, and I forget the exact term that they came up with, it was really good term and I should be remembering it, but it was essentially that the social net that people have wasn't as capable of catching people before they reach homelessness in many communities of color. People were just as willing to help out when someone was kind of on the verge of homelessness in black communities as they were in white communities. But what they actually found is when communities of color, when that would happen, it actually, because of all the stresses that are already kind of there and, implicit in our system, it actually brought everybody involved closer to homelessness than just lifting someone out of or preventing that homelessness. And so I thought that was a really kind of important thing. We spent so much time talking about affordable housing, but we really didn't delve into some of, you know, as Lori has mentioned, the overrepresentation of Blacks in evictions, and also the overrepresentation of Blacks in homelessness and kind of what's at the root of that. And so, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about policy, but we didn't discuss any policy that might start to address those sorts of things. And I think that's a really important conversation to be having.
So let's go there. We have a policymaker sitting at the table right now. From your position, Matt, like, what are the policies that could help address that?
Well, you know, I mean, that's a million-dollar question, I think. I mean, some simple ideas that, you know, I can't claim are mine, come from the authors of the study, was kind of looking at the way we direct our homeless-related resources. We spent a lot of time and money and resources directed at folks who are already experiencing homelessness. But what if we flipped that a little bit and created a system that was more designed to, I mean, you look at the factors that sometimes lead to homelessness, and they're simple stuff, you know, like my car broke down and I couldn't get to work anymore, or, you know, I was on the verge of eviction, or I had a utility bill that got too high and I couldn't pay it anymore. What if we had a system that was more designed or better designed or better equipped to kind of step in and prevent that homelessness before it reaches homelessness, rather than just shoveling millions of dollars at folks once they're already experiencing homelessness, trying to then lift them out of that? And that's one idea that came from policymakers. And I also think you can look at things like, you know, I mean, you look at like ban the box type stuff on you know, job applications. I mean, those same factors play in when folks are looking for housing, you know, and you look at the overpopulation of African Americans that, you know, are interacting with our criminal justice system. So those same sorts of barriers are in place when people are looking at housing. And so what if there was a way to, you know, ban the box for housing or something? And I know they've tried to get at stuff like that in Seattle. And, you know, I think the most recent thing they did was, you know, trying to do a first come, first serve thing. And that's
kind of, and then the court said that's unconstitutional.
Right. But I think they're on the right path of kind of looking at some of those things. And so I'd love to see a much more robust conversation about some of those sorts of things.
And I think we'll see a ban the box. So we did ban the box on hiring this year, right? So I think that next year we're likely to see a bill come to the Judiciary Committee that I chair, doing a ban the box on rental housing. And I think, you know, one of the challenges with that is that you'll hear from landlords is, right, they're subject to a lawsuit if they rent to somebody who's a sex offender who then offends within the complex and stuff like that. So they want some protections there. So that's why these things always get more complicated. But like one of the things we did this year was we finally, after trying for many, many years, banned source of income discrimination, which I think will help because
I think I know what you mean by that, but could you explain what source of income discrimination means?
So, you know, right now, Section 8 housing is only if you get some kind of voucher for housing, a landlord could say, yeah, I don't want that. Yeah. Or if you're paying for your house, they can basically discriminate based on where your income is coming from, even if you have enough income to rent. But one of the things that we heard from landlords was that they were worried that Section 8 renters, and I don't really think there's a lot of evidence of this, but they were worried about the Section 8 renters being difficult on the property. And so we actually created a landlord mitigation fund. And which will let, if they have a Section 8 renter who moves out and has trashed the place, it'll let them access the mitigation fund to rehabilitate the property and re-rent it. And the other thing it'll do is let them access that fund to bring their housing up to a quality that would be that would be authorized to be Section 8 housing. So hopefully create a little bit more access around that. So that, I mean, it is once you, for me, when I'm still learning as a legislator, but if I really try and deeply listen to people and what they're saying and kind of sweep away a lot of the bias stuff, there are ways to actually have win-win solutions that are actually really good. You know, at first I was like, landlord mitigation fund, chimney Christmas, why do we need that? But really, when you listen to it, it actually has the potential to have help create a little bit more and better housing. I think the other thing is, you know, before the Great Recession, we were investing in Washington State $200 million in the Housing Trust Fund, which is all about building affordable housing. And we haven't even gotten, I don't think, maybe we're up at $100 million now. But, you know, part of our problem is that we don't have enough space in shelters for people. Once we get somebody in shelters, we don't have enough space in transitional housing. Mm-hmm. We don't have enough affordable housing. So you can't move people through the system into affordable housing. And so that's really creating a lot of issues around homelessness and creating homelessness. So we have to find ways to build more affordable housing. And then build it in a way, you know, like one of the other good things we've done is we've gotten this transformation waiver that lets some Medicaid dollars be used to provide supportive services. You have a lot of folks with a mental illness or some kind of other disability or maybe a substance use disorder that they need some wraparound services. We've never been able to use Medicaid dollars to provide the supportive housing services for them. So it doesn't pay for their rent. It pays for the supportive services around that. And we're now able to do that. So we're going to be able to experiment a little and see how well that works. There's a lot of good research out there on it.
Listening to both of you, I'm reminded of two things. One, I'm reminded is that, so we've seen, there's a report in the news maybe like this week that the fever is kind of broken on the Seattle rental market. And so that they basically have built enough housing that there are places now offering like first month's free move-in specials, which means that it's a buyer's market or a renter's market rather than a landlord's market, at least for the moment. We've had the conversation now in Tacoma a couple of times, Adults Fix Happy Hour, that we're having a problem building more housing in Tacoma because if you're a builder, why build in Tacoma when it's the same labor pool that you build in Seattle and make more money from what you're building? So I think about if the answer is building more housing, what are the mechanisms of government we can use to build more housing? And then Matt, from what you said, it sounds to me that we have a homeless problem. If I have your belief right, we have a homeless problem that's really, we don't have a safety net. And that we need to invest in the safety net, and that will actually reduce the homelessness.
Yeah, I think we need to, without critiquing too much how we're currently allocating our resources, because I think a lot of it's very good. I think we're starting to get there. I do think we really need to start looking at addressing some of the root causes of homelessness better than thinking about homelessness once it has already happened. And, you know, it's interesting, Lori brought it up and you kind of brought it up as well. And it's one of the places that my mind went directly after we taped that last episode was the potential of a local Pierce County Affordable Housing Trust Fund. We've tried to do it a couple times, at least. Voters never go for it to the point where, you know, folks who live and breathe that kind of stuff have almost just gotten burned out of even talking about the idea. Yeah. Just because.
Wait, were you all on that massive email chain that started about community land trust? I think like Sound Partnership folks started it. It was a okay. There's a conversation that's been happening since the last Adult Civics Happy Hour about housing, about community land trusts. Mm-hmm. And it's just one of those things. I'll put some of that in the show notes as well. Yeah. Sorry, you were saying.
No, that's totally cool because I think it's in the same thread. But you know, so I wonder as we've kind of reached this crisis point. I mean, crisis is a word that gets thrown around a lot lately. But, you know, in terms of affordable housing, we've reached a point in Pierce County and certainly Tacoma where, you know, people perhaps hopefully looking for answers where they haven't been willing to look for answers in the past. And I really think the Affordable Housing Trust Fund and the potential of something that is very real. And maybe there's a political will and more importantly, a will amongst the voters to make something like that happen, because it's failed at least a couple times in the past. But, you know, you talk about the need to build, you know, and going back to the homeless. I mean, that's precisely what we're seeing in Tacoma. We opened the Dome District stability site. It immediately filled up. It's been full for months. There's something like an 80-person waiting list. We've moved 30 people into more stable housing in the almost year it's been open. 10 months, I think it's been open, because there's no place to. There's a total lack of transitional housing and permanent housing to move folks out of it, and so it just gets stuck. And so we could, you know, yeah, we need more shelter space in Tacoma. Absolutely, there are people sleeping on the streets every night, and that is that's terrible. But we could open shelters, 2, 3, 4 of them, and they would just fill up. And unless we have some place to get that system and move them to the next step, it's just another shelter filling up.
Yeah. And I think we better really watch out, because I think we've got more of a problem than our neighbor to the north has. So, right, the guy who wrote Evicted just did this whole national thing where he's looking at evictions in every county in the country. So if you look at comparing Pierce County and King County, Pierce County has over twice the eviction rate of King County. So we had in 2015 1,100 evictions in Pierce County. King County had 1,400, yet they're 2.5 times the size of us by population, right? And when you start to look at our incomes here in Pierce County and rent costs mm-hmm. as a percentage of income, I think that, you know, when we're talking about homelessness, one of the primary ways we could start to address homelessness is start to address evictions. So because what happens is when somebody gets evicted, it's not just one problem, it turns into 12 problems. So then if you're applying for jobs, you don't have an address to apply for a job. You don't have an address to use if you're getting any kind of state or federal benefit. Your whole life unravels as a result of losing an address. And, you know, and historically, although Washington State has now banned much of considering prior evictions when doing new rents. But once you had one eviction on your record, you were done for. That was it. I mean, one of the other things in this book is it says that actually people who are in the lowest housing, the lowest quality housing, are frequently paying a lot more in rent than people who are paying or people who are living in much better quality housing. Because of the, I mean, in Milwaukee, and it, you know, I grew up in Wisconsin. I grew up directly west of Milwaukee, and Milwaukee's always been known as one of the most segregated cities in the nation, in part because they had all these enclaves, right? But because all those enclaves exist, people are all crammed into one part of the city, that affects the whole, all of the housing in that part of the city. So there are a lot, I think Pierce County should be very concerned about some of this new data that he's produced. But there are things that we can do about it.
Yeah. The idea that essentially we have rents that are heading towards 70% of what they are in Seattle, right, but incomes that are right south of 50%. And those numbers are off the top of my dome. They're not the right numbers, but they're not far off.
Right.
Like that gives me pause as well. I want to go back to the point that you and Matt started with about the racialized nature of all of this. And I guess my question is, what are the legislative or other policy solutions that we can get to remedy that besides the box? Or what are things that, like, that, what are remedies we haven't discussed yet?
I don't know. I mean, I think we're struggling on both. When I talked in the beginning about the mass incarceration of African-American men.
Yeah. Can we go back to that? Because uh-huh. we were talking about that downstairs, uh-huh. but Matt wasn't here for that conversation quite in depth. I have the idea that Evicted and the new Jim Crow go hand in hand.
Yeah.
You brought a new element to that, that the new Jim Crow is what's happening to black men and Evicted is what's happening to black women.
Yeah.
Well, walk us through that one more time, because that's, I'm still nodding my head when you said that 20 minutes ago downstairs.
Yeah. Well, just that the new Jim Crow is all about how we've set up our systems and structures to fairly intentionally incarcerate African-American men, men of color generally, but really African-American men, with the things that we criminalize and the way in which we sentence based on that. But, you know, I think he makes a really good case in Evicted. When you look at African-American women being evicted, they're just evicted at a much higher rate, even when they have the same income as white women and things like that. And so evictions are a very discretionary process, just like arresting is actually a discretionary process.
Sure.
And charging people is a discretionary process. So I guess the fact of the matter is people are using their discretion to attack a particular part of the community. And I think in a lot of ways, unknowingly, but systemically, it's very intentional.
Can I put on my skeptic hat? And this is not my hat. This is not my skeptic hat. My skeptic hat, not my take. But let's say that I'm my typical listener's conservative uncle. And I'm listening to this conversation and I'm hearing what you're saying. I'm nodding at what you're saying. But like, I also believe that more Black people get evicted because more Black people aren't paying their rent. Is it really that simple?
That's not what the data says. What the data says is that there are equal percentages, representative percentages, white people, Black people, yeah. Asians, Latinos, who are not paying their rent. Yet African-American women in particular get evicted at a much higher rate, even though others may also not be paying their rent. Others, what the research is showing, says in this book, is that, for example, if you compare white women and Black women, white women are allowed to go into arrears much further before an eviction process starts to take place. You know, I mean, one of the things we could think about doing as a policy would be to provide representation for folks who are being evicted, or to provide a mediation process. Or something like that, like we could think about, I don't know if the county has jurisdiction, but, you know, using the Pierce County Center for Dialogue and Resolution and have eviction cases go to them for some kind of mediation before they actually go to court, something like that. That might resolve a lot of things, and it would probably be maybe better for landlords too.
Yeah, I'm growing more and more passionate about the importance of civil representation. So like in class right now, we're doing civil liberties. And in fact, tomorrow's about criminal procedure. We're gonna talk about the Fourth Amendment, talk about the exclusionary rule, talk about the right to counsel. But the fact that the right to counsel does not extend to civil cases is an injustice that brings a ton of burden onto low-income families. And we see that with immigration, and we see that with evictions.
One of the good things I will tell you that we're doing, because this was my bill this session, is we have an Office of Civil Legal Aid here in Washington that's been dramatically underfunded. But each of the last 2 years, we've added a number of attorneys to it this year, and we did this year. Now we also updated their statute so that they can actually represent people in evictions.
Very cool.
So that won't mean everybody will get represented, but it will start to mean more access for that particular issue.
And the stat in the book, I believe, is if you have a lawyer, you're 10 times more likely to stay in your house than not having a lawyer. Matt, give me your last thoughts.
You know, It's interesting, going back to the skeptic uncle thing that you brought up, and, you know, tying it to.
And by the way, not my uncle.
No,
not my
uncle. Your uncle. Yeah. No, maybe my uncle.
I have quite
from
a
Missouri,
few skeptical
as they say it.
Actually,
you know, and that's something I constantly deal with in my line of work too. And, you know, I'd written something fairly recently about crime and mass incarceration and the overpopulation of African Americans in the criminal justice system. And, you know, it kind of goes back to that same sentiment of, well, are they just, you know, are Black people just commit more crimes? And the fact of the matter is, much like the evictions we see, crime has gone down since the 90s. You could chart the rise in the prison population from, you know, the mid 90s to about 2010. During that same time that we've seen that spike in the prison population, largely among African American men, we've actually seen crime go down. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to suggest that African American women are being evicted because they're, you know, paying their rent less often, or that Black men are being incarcerated more because they're committing more crimes, it's simply not what the data shows. So it's important to challenge that kind of narrative, because that narrative is so prevalent and so easy to kind of fall into thinking, but it's just, you know, the data does not suggest that's the case.
Yeah. One of the, it cracks me up. We talk about this every year at some point. All the data says that basically all races use drugs at the same rates, mm-hmm. right? But we look at who gets busted for drug crimes. And then my students, a couple years ago, took one step further. They're like, everybody uses drugs, but the kids, and I won't say names of high schools, but kids in more pale parts of town, those are where the good parties are, because they actually afford the good drugs.
I can tell you, growing up, the likelihood that I was going to get busted for dope.
Right, right.
Do you think it wasn't there?
Yeah.
But the likelihood that I was going to, you know, get busted for dope was almost minuscule.
Yeah, yeah. And my students talk a lot about how the kids, and again, no names, Mig Barber, seem to have amazing amounts and quality and quantities of drugs. There's one more. I'm going to regret that. I'm going to let it ride. There's one more thought I kind of want to put on the table for you all before we take off and you go to the hear the mayor speak. One aspect of the Book of Evicted that really resonated with me is the fact that a landlord relationship used to be, I own one house, now I own a second house, or my second house to you. And now there's like an industrial complex where we have property managers and we have holding corporations that own hundreds, if not thousands, of homes in a metro area. So the dynamic between renter and landlord's been shifted like drastically within our lifetime, essentially. Like this is an alteration of the social contract on renting. I don't think you can put that genie back in the bottle. But what are ways that we can, besides representation, that we can mitigate the impact that is institutional landlords the term we're going to use right now? Sure. But these large institutional chain landlords and property managers, that how do we mitigate? How do we make sure protections are there besides representation?
You're looking at me?
I'm looking around. I think
if you ask a question, you should actually make a suggestion about how
we do it. I
was going to
say, I love that the legislator is just as stumped on this stuff as right? It makes me feel really good.
I'm a high school teacher, man. Like,
I told him I wanted to come and hear everybody else talk about Evicted and what ideas they had. Because I think these are really, these are really hard questions to figure out answers to. I guess my biggest lesson as a legislator in the last couple of years is every solution brings a new problem.
That's fair.
And every problem brings new opportunities also. But so trying to figure out how you do these things, I do think, though, your observation is correct in the sense that you don't have relationship, really. Although I thought it was interesting in the book, right? There was I can't remember her name, but one of the main characters, right, who owns a whole bunch of property, and she had her own ways of assessing who she was going to give a break to and who she wasn't, and when she was done and when she wasn't done. That's not a very systemic approach to addressing the issue. So how you figure out a systemic approach, I think, is the question, or if there can be one.
So please.
Just my wild evergreen hat going on for the one thing that was mentioned in the book, and it's along the lines, and I will say that in our previous conversation, this is one of the areas that we did actually delve into, so I got to give us some credit. We did actually get there about the landlord, industrial complex has really changed, and it's a new thing. I think people tend to think about, current, and, it must have always been this way. It wasn't always this way. But one thing that used to exist that was mentioned in the book is tenants unions. Mm-hmm. Have unions that represented renters. And now it's kind of just like this, you're fending for yourself, feels, you're up against these. I mean, anecdotally, we have this house in our neighborhood. We saw the family move out. We wondered what was up. All of a sudden, a for rent sign went up for it. We learned that it's some company in Seattle that's doing the renting. And, this Latino family moved in, and they must have everybody in their family living in this house, presumably to afford it. And it's about the only way you can do it. But it can feel like you're up against this huge machine, right, as a renter. And so I'm wondering if there isn't a way to give renters more power, similarly to, what we've seen in the past, something like a tenant union of some sort, or some way to give representation and power to renters in a system where, having been a renter in the past, I just feel like that representation, that feeling of some power just is non-existent.
Well, one of the bills we heard this year, and there weren't the votes to get it out of committee, and there wouldn't have been off the floor of the House, but we have a fairly longstanding absolute prohibition against rent control in Washington State. So, and the state has occupied the whole area. What we've said is no jurisdiction can do rent control. I think we should probably repeal that statute and let local jurisdictions engage in what they need to engage in to see what they need to do to address, homelessness and affordable housing and all kinds of things like this. There are a lot of different models for it. it wouldn't be the same in every community, but I don't think Washington State should get involved in that kind of absolute prohibition. So, I mean, I'd like to see us lift that. I think that's going to be a lot of long, long, hard work to make that happen.
So I'm going to walk away from this conversation thinking about a couple of things. I'm going to be walking away thinking about how colorblind policies can have racialized outcomes, which we've seen now in Evicted and we see in the new Jim Crow.
I do just want to say about that, one of the things that really overlaps those two, court system.
Yes.
So just people should really think about that.
And that's actually the second thing I'm going to walk away with, that if you are passionate about this, one of the things we need to do is organize and advocate to get people representation in civil cases, eviction, immigration. The third thing I'm walking away with is that we need to have an honest societal conversation about how the housing stock not being owned by people in the community impacts the people who reside in the community. And the idea that we have these outside hedge funds holding companies from God knows where, Bain Capital, whatever, what's his name, dude in Omaha, Nebraska, owning hundreds of homes and communities is actually not good for the community. And those are three things I'm walking away with. I want to thank you all for coming to my classroom today. It's not quite the studio. I'm sure the kids outside, noise is going to be on the microphone. And especially thanks to y'all for sitting in student desks. You look adorable.
Good. This is real. I appreciate it.
Right. So, audience, thanks for listening. And the next one will be out in 7 days. See ya. Channel 253 is sponsored by Alaska Airlines. I'm Nate Bowling, and I fly Alaska. To book your next trip, go to alaskaair.com. The Nerd Farmer podcast is part of the Channel 253 Podcast Network. Check out our other shows. Move to Tacoma, the OG original with the Pod Auntie. Ob, the Interchangeable White Ladies. Citizen Tacoma, Crossing Division. Flounders B-Team, a local soccer show. And Taco Man.
This is Channel 253.